When I went in Aliyah, I went to take a Birchat Preda from the Rav, from Reb David Lifshitz, and from Yaakov Moshe Cohen lesson. So I went into Reb David. I just tell you about Reb David now, because I don't have time for the rest. So Reb David said to me, "Who did be Evrit? That I yodei etse. Who am Ali? Ataloma fached? Amati lo kvod harash yeshiva. Ani somech al tzva haganali Yisrael v'al HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Yafeh. V'amata b'seid hanachon." And then we started to talk about when Yaakov Avinu prepared for his meeting with Esav. So that answers your question. Now, today's shiur...
The army did enough.
The army hasn't done enough. They're inside, they're fighting, they kill, they destroy. But as much as you do, it's just... defies imagination how stupid Rabin and Barak and Balin and Peres, how stupid they were. But my neighbor, I have a great neighbor, Rabbi Yeshua Hutner, should live and be well. He's about 91 now. His mind is unbelievably good, but his body, it's a gone idea. Rabbi Yeshua Hutner, the Sedatim Sakhavit Pamurka. So I go to visit him very often. So he told me, he said, "Look, they meant well. People thought there was a chance at peace. They meant well. But look how they misjudged. Look how they took every cent, every opportunity to build, to construct. All right, to kill us." And it just defies imagination. 5 o'clock news, they're shooting Qassams in again. It's headlines all over the world. All right, let's learn Torah. So at least we can't do the Tzava part. I depend upon my grandson went into the Navy today. The Navy is after him. And he has a 97 profile, the highest profile possible. 3 points lost for a Brit Mila. And he has a high IQ and he knows languages. So the Navy, he's getting gibush this week to see whether he can be in officer's training. Then I'll have to decide what to do. He wanted to go to Hezda, so he has to see. That's one grandson. My other grandson already chose Hakotel. And my son-in-law is Skana Luftzvakeva. So they're doing the army, but we have to do the Torah. Now, today's year, today and next week are very fascinating. And we'll end off Geirut, and then we move on to Orachayim, to a world that is unbelievably interesting, although not as halachically earth-shaking. And you see, with Rav Herzog, there's no question that Rav Yitzchak Isaac Alevi Herzog took the position that when you talk in terms of Gentiles that risked their life to save Jews, when you talk in terms of Gentiles who are willing to come in Aliyah, we have to accommodate them. On the other hand, he raised the issue that haunts us, that today, in the state of Israel, the most famous Jews are not religious. And you take for granted, just as Rav Herzog says, just as in two modern times, when you became a Jew, it was taken for granted you became a total Jew. There was no other way to be a Jew, which Shmirat Mitzvot, Kashrut, Tarat Mishpacha. But in modern times, and Rav Herzog says it with bitterness in his voice, who are the leaders of the Jewish people if not Poshei Yisrael? Again, it's hard language to use. I wouldn't use that language because they're certainly Tunokach and Ishpun, the full sense of the word. But you look around, you look at Tommy Lapid, you look at the last election, you look at some of the element in the Avodah. Likud doesn't have that element. Likud, it has a lot of Sfadic votes, traditional votes, and many of their Chavrei Knesset, the men and the women, have a din of Shomrei Shabbos. I can give you names, but many of them, even Meir Shitrit, who, believe me, I don't agree with some of his outlooks, he's not Machal, he's a Shomrei Shabbos Meir Shitrit. Katzav, the president of the state of Israel, is 100% a Shomer Shabbos. Bechutz, Bifnim, the way he raised his children all went to Chorev, all did Hezda. I mean, you can't ask for more than that. He doesn't wear a yarmulke, right? Svadim don't wear a yarmulke. I wish he would wear a yarmulke, because it would be a statement the whole world would see the president of the state of Israel wears a kippah. It's not halachically. Halachically, you don't have to wear a kippah. No one has to. I'm not such an amaritz. I know that halachically wearing a kippah is only a minhag, and it's a late minhag, and only the Ashkenazim took it on. The Sfadim go to business without kippah, and I'm well aware of it. I'm well aware of it. The Yekis, listen, Rav Shinja Ful Hirsch, they say sat without a kippah, unless he was learning and davening or benching, eating, whatever it was. So I'm well aware of it. But today a kippah, you see, it's like a women's aliyahs. I told you more than once. Eidar, there's a lot to be said about it. I have their conference. I now know what went on at the conference, and I know what they're planning. Maybe we'll talk about it tomorrow or some other day. But But I don't have to be a big lamdan to know that you can give a woman an aliyah. It's an open gemara. I covered at Sibah, I'll give you a pilpul in 2 minutes. I'll solve the problem of covered at Sibah. But bisman hazeh, that's what I told Nari Hefska, to give a woman aliyah, in my opinion, is the end of Yiddishkeit. We're finished. We're conservative Jews. You open the floodgate because the feminist movement is shaking at our boundaries. And we have to stand firm with all. No one has a better track record than the person speaking. I've taught more women than I think anyone in this generation. And my track record stands, and I've taught them with dignity, and I taught them at the highest level. I remember I would be so tired. You don't know how hard I worked when I was younger. And at times I would say, in Midrashit Moriah, I don't think I said it in Michlala Machon Gol because I was younger then. I was teaching there until 85 and in the other place 89. But in Midrash Moriah, I would say, gentlemen. And the girls would all laugh. But I said, you know, girls, that shows you that psychologically I'm not talking any different to you than I talk in the Kollel. If I can say gentlemen, it's a compliment. And the girls understood what I was saying. So, but it's their problems. We have to relate to it. We have to make clear, but if we're Talmidim of the Rav and we want to live in the Western world, we have to surrender to Halacha. We can't allow fashions to interfere with our total grounding and commitment to the Dvar Hashem Zu Halacha. And a yarmulke today is a symbol. Halavai, he would wear a yarmulke, but he's a frum Jew 100%. Many of the women are not mechallel at Shabbos. Even that Penina Rosenblum, who was a former Miss Israel, she was a beauty contest winner. She went into the cosmetics business. By the way, she's an admirable woman. She comes from absolute poverty, abject poverty. You know, European parents may even be survivors who got here in the 30s. And she raised herself. Husband puts on tefillin every day. I don't believe she's... I believe she's not Mechallel at Shabbos, but Presej, the Din of Shomer Shabbos. Now, she's not in the Knesset yet. She's the next one, I believe, that will get in if one of the first 40 fall out. I think she was 42nd on the list. Mashu, because they're 41, and whatever it is. Okay. Anyway, Halavai would wear a yarmulke. But Rav Herzog is right. The world knows Sharon. Amri Sharon is in the headlines. I don't have to give you the names. You will understand. It's a very important point. Nevertheless, he's worried. You know, so when you convert today, you convert. You want to be like all the Jews. But except, this is the opposite of Rav Moshe. Reb Meisha said, maybe I can be Melamed Zchut, and those who convert, because they're converting you in accordance with what you think Judaism is, in this accordance with the Gemara and Klal Gadol, we spoke about so many times, Amit Gaya Bein Akam. And Rav Herzog says just the opposite. He takes the same sword and turns it all the way around. But nevertheless, we have to do what we can. And we're going to come back. I'm going to show you something. I don't know if I'll reach it this week or next week, something that will shake you to your inner core. Then we come to Rav Unterman. And as I explained, Rav Unterman was a fine Anglo-Saxon gentleman. It's interesting that all the chief rabbis spoke perfect English. It's very fascinating. Rav Kook was rabbi in England during World War I. He spoke English. I don't know how well, but I know, I think I told you the story. I told it after class. I don't want to mention names, but when he came to America in 1924, I did a research paper. It's my first piece of research. I won $50. I was a junior in college and I did research. I won $50. You have no idea how much money that was at that time. Yeah, but I was a poor kid. For me, it was like $10,000, not $1,000. You kids are rich. To you, $1,000, you burn it in a cigar. But for me, $50, and you don't know or none. There was a whole machloket on the committee because it was a prize for research in Jewish history. And some chatzufim among the professors said American Jews have no history. It's not history, because it's American Jewish history. But the majority went out, and I got the prize. So I did. I published it, and it appears in the Rakafet Aron Chelik Aleph. I published it after the Jewish Life. It's a nice little piece. And I dealt with the rabbinic delegation that came to America in 1924 to raise funds for Rav Kook, Rav the Kovner Rav, Rav Dovid Kahn Shapira, and the Lush Mordechai, Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein, who was assisted by Rav Yaakov Moshe Cohen Lessen. It was very fascinating. If I start talking about it, I'll talk for hours because I can give you mus, I can tell you stories that are Rav Sinigra. But what's fascinating is they welcomed them to City Hall. Mayor, I believe it was Walker. Mayor Walker spoke, and he welcomed Jimmy Walker, gave this talk. And then Rav Kook responded and spoke modern Hebrew. And an American rabbi, an Orthodox rabbi, translated into English. And Rav Kook said to those standing next to him, what an amoret. He doesn't know what I said. You know, he translated into English as with nothing to do with what Rav Kook really said. But he never didn't understand Hebrew. So Rav Kook spoke English. Rav Herzog, of course, was native to English, got his doctorate in London, grew up in Paris, London. Rav Unterman was native to English, was rabbi in Liverpool for many years in England. He was a fine gentleman. I knew him. Rav Goren knew English. He was unbelievable. Who comes after Rav Goren? Rav Avram Shapiro didn't know English. He's the exception. And Rabbi Lau, as you know, is a kunstmacher. He speaks English, too. When he goes to the OU, he speaks in English. I don't think he's anywhere nearly as good in English as he is in Hebrew, but for the women who paid a fortune to go to the convention to come home and tell their friends that they heard the chief rabbi of Israel, you know my vote. I say, if Aaron Rekepit speaks at an OU convention, he does, and he's no good, it's a waste of time to throw eggs at him. But the chief rabbi of Israel can say whatever he wants. He can be totally irrelevant and totally nothing with nothing. But they heard the chief rabbi. You understand? That's what's important. So he speaks English. Anyway, coming back here, so Rav Unterman deals with the Russian immigration. It's Noam. It's the first time someone is dealing it in great detail. And he says very easily that in Chutz Laretz, he didn't convert. There was a fear of assimilation. But he says in Eretz Yisrael, they're coming, they suffered. And he makes the point, we ended off the class last week, he makes the point that the Gentiles coming out of Russia have two advantages. One, they didn't absorb Christianity, because they had no religion whatsoever. The Russians were taught that what is attributed to Karl Marx, a religion is the opium of the masses. And I can tell you, I know Russian refusnikim who came in Aliyah. Some of them, by the way, one of them was elected to the Knesset in the Shinui Party, Shlepak. These were famous names. And you weren't alive yet or you were kids. These were famous refusnikim. They absolutely have no use for religion whatsoever. And I remember Dina Balin, again, it's a famous name. I don't know where she's at today. It's a famous refusnik who risked her life and spoke in public against when they arrested Sharansky and others. They kicked her out. Last I saw her years ago, she lived in Ramat. She once said to me, how can an intelligent man like you believe in religion? Then she apologized. I said, you don't have to apologize. I can take it. But she said to me, how can an intelligent man like you... See, you know what I answered her? I said, you're only a Jew because all your forebears practiced Torah for endless generations. I said, think about it. You ask me how I can believe in religion? And I said, my great-great-great-grandchildren will only be Jewish if they live with Torah. Once you leave generation two, three, it's gone. It's forgotten. Who knows? Maybe she came back until now. But it's ingrained within them. And Rav Unterman is right. They're a totally a blank mind when it comes to religion. So therefore, it's not getting the Christianity out of them. And then he makes the second point. They saw the Jews persecuted. Since they saw the Jews persecuted, they had affinity for the Jews. They saw the persecution, and therefore we have to do what we can. L'karev otam. Now, the problem of going back to the Chiloni Kibbutz, we'll deal with tomorrow in class. It's a real problem he raises us here. We'll deal with it with the Rav tomorrow, Helen Zeidman. It's a terrible problem. How can you convert if you know the person's going to a kibbutz where there's no Shabbat and no Kashrut? And even if they say they're going to keep Shabbat and Kashrut, how can you keep Shabbat and Kashrut in such an environment? A problem it is. And he's aware of the problem. You have to remember the kibbutzim, not so much today. Today the kibbutzim are discredited. You know, the kibbutz, everyone used to say that communism only succeeded one place in the world, the state of Israel, the kibbutz. Today we know that communism only succeeded in the state of Israel because the Israeli governments poured in billions of dollars to the kibbutzim. No, it's no secret when the Mapayim and the Mapam controlled the state of Israel and Achdut Avodah, it's before your time. So all the money that they want to take away from Shas and the Agudat Yisrael today, all that money went to the kibbutzim. Billions and billions of dollars. No, it's no secret. You can have a kibbutz with a beautiful lawn, with a swimming pool where every member has his own car. Sure, the government is paying for it. So now I ask you, did communism really succeed in Israel? In other words, now we see the kibbutzim are bankrupt, they're selling off. All right, I'm not it. You can deal with it. It's a question for you to think about. But it's a problem. He leaves that problem open. Now, I want to pick up where I left off last week, and this is something where I wish Reuven Bleich were here, because none of you can understand this. Your generation can't understand this. My generation can. And I have to use a Hebrew word here, and I have to say something. Ain't in the dictionary. Is that right or is that wrong? Avery, what do you say? Ain't is in the dictionary today. When I was growing up, ain't in the dictionary. Why? Because it's not a word, no such word. However, what establishes words? Common usage. Look into the unabridged Webster, you'll find that ain't is in the dictionary today. It's a slang, it's a word, we use it. That's the way language develops. And this is a basic rule of language. In Hebrew, where we have grammar, we have halachic problems. For instance, Tosfot already discusses it. Shabbat, Sacha, or Nekeva. Right or wrong? The Gemara in Psachim, many words. Derech achad, pam achad, pam. You look into the Chafetz Chaim, Mishneh Berurah, it says pam echad. In modern Hebrew, if you wrote that on a test, the teacher would correct it. Pam achad. Okay. So, ain't in the dictionary. Language is created by the people. We have created a new word today that didn't exist when I was growing up, didn't exist when I came in Aliyah. The word Haredi. What does Haredi mean? Haredi means, I've been often asked for a definition. First of all, it's not a pejorative word anymore. It's not like you say someone is used to say a Shvatzer. That's a pejorative term. You don't use that term. I try to correct my grandchildren live in Israel, grew up here, and I hear they picked up that word somehow. And I correct them. It's not nice. It's not good. Don't use it. Use Afro-American. So then they, I had a balabus in Maplewood, vice president, multimillionaire, Zichron Levrachi, has from grandchildren, so I admire him because his family came to America before the Civil War. Before the Civil War. And he was a frum guy. Somehow they can, and he has children graduated, family graduated, YU, Bernard Rebel, Smicha, grandchildren who studied with me here in BMT years ago, and they're all frum. And he used to get up in shul, a multimillionaire, and yell, "They're niggers!" And he says, "I can prove it! Nigeria! Nigeria!" And I was a young rabbi, and let me tell you, gentlemen, I may have been right or wrong, but I kept my mouth shut. I didn't start up with Mr. Abe Zemel. Take my word for it. I knew which side my bread was buttered. I waived the argument. I don't know if I could be. Mordechai, you have every right to laugh at me and every right to say the Rebbe was wrong. But, a rabbi in a pulpit is not a Rebbe behind the microphone. I did not take him on. But use a proper word. Haredi today is not pejorative. What does Haredi mean? So I'll define it. This is Rakefet's definition. I've defined it many times. Haredi is someone who, generally speaking, is opposed to stepping into the Western world and has, at best, a non-plus attitude towards Yom HaTzmut. In other words, he may not be negative, but he's certainly not positive. At best. The famous definition. They talk about some day school in America where the Rebbe said, the Rebbe's from Lakewood, the kids are from modern Orthodox homes, and the Rebbe says, "We will do like Ben-Gurion on Yom HaTzmut. We will not say Hallel, we will not say Tachman." Ben-Gurion said neither. You follow me, Aaron? Ben-Gurion said neither, we'll do neither. So that's my definition of Haredi. Why am I saying that's the way we use the term today, right? It's not pejorative. If you would be writing about Aaron Rakefet, you would say he's dati. You write about someone else, he's Haredi. It doesn't mean that he's more learned or more pious or more this and more that. It just represents a certain difference in outlook. Generally speaking, a Haredi person will dress a certain way, wear a uniform, might have a beard, payas, etc. But even that, in Israel, it's very hard to say rule of the thumb because many datiyim have beards and payas, including my own grandchildren have payas that wind around 100 times over, and they're datiyim, they're not Haredim. But that's definition. I'm just using a word. What's your problem? I haven't said a word yet. Yoni, what's your problem? Go ahead, ask the question, but I haven't said a word yet. Right, the word chavshi was used, correct, instead of kiloni. But I'll tell you why am I giving this introduction. You're going to see in a minute. Now, originally the word charedi was used for frum people in general. Chared l'dva Hashem. And it had nothing to do with dati charedi. This is a recent development that now enters the dictionary. Originally, all that chared meant with someone who is Shoma Mitzvot. Now, give me 1 second, Aaron. What does it mean? How can I prove this? I'm talking with the Rosh Yeshiva of Shvutami. This is Rabbi Aya Levine's grandson-in-law. It's Rabbi Eliashiv's nephew, Rabbi Eliezer Kugel, a year ago in a tzaddik, not a young man anymore, in his late 70s. I know him for many decades already. So I told him I was invited to speak at the OU. Hulama de Banglet. I gave him the official Hebrew translation of the OU. Do you know the official translation? Igur HaKilot HaCharediot. So right away I realized, he looked at me, what malacham igud kilot charediot? You know what, Satna's going to invite me to speak? Agud is going to invite me to speak? So I realized, I explained to him, this is very, why is this so important? Because now he describes an unbelievable problem. He says, you see, when a person converts, they're influenced by the Jews they see. And he says, let me tell you a story about what I had in the rabbinate in Liverpool. This is the middle of the tshuva. This is what I'm calling from Noam Yudalid, and this is in the middle of the tshuva by Rav Issa Yehuda Unterman. And he says, let me tell you a story. Now your generation won't recognize this. My generation will. Bounce it off Reuven Bleich and see what he tells you. He says a certain Jew who was considered Yehudi Haredi, he uses the word Haredi, Shoma mitzvot, v'shayach lebeit knesset orthodoxy, nitalmein, his wife died, and he wanted to marry, these are his words, a very important Gentile woman. Now, what does it mean, a very important woman? It probably means a sophisticated, well-known woman, a well-placed Gentile woman, wanted to marry her. And this woman says that she's been thinking of converting, she really wants to become Jewish. It's true that marriage now has encouraged her to take the step, but this concept was in her mind for a while. So Rav Unterman says it would appear that this is an ideal concept. Here's a woman coming towards Judaism, meets a fine Jewish man. Look at the example he's going to set. He is an Orthodox man. He is considered Yehudi Haredi. And then he says, but let me tell you about this man. This man goes to shul Shabbos morning, and then he goes into his firm for at least 3 hours every Saturday. He is one of the leading executives, and people ask him, how do you go into your business on Shabbos? You're an Orthodox Jew. He says, well, generally speaking, I don't do any malacha. And he puts in parentheses, everyone knows that this man is a chain smoker during the week. He does not smoke on Shabbos. Everyone knows that on Shabbos, he walks to his office, even though it is a long walk. But he says, once in a while, they're very important papers he has to sign or he has to get on the telephone. And this is something he can't do with a Gentile. You can understand what we're talking about. It's some business deal. He has to make some big decision. Or you need his signature. I need not tell you that telling a guy to sign for you, it's not like in America where someone brings you registered mail on Shabbos and you tell the postman, look, I can't sign, I'm a rabbi. He says, oh, rabbi, I'll sign for you. You know, most goyim, your problem is when it's a Jewish mailman. That's when you have a problem. But Baruch Hashem, most postmen, Rove, are not Jews today. They're not Jews. And my father was a postman. And you should know, during the Yom Kippur War, before I volunteered for the army, I volunteered, I was a postman. And I delivered mail. Talmidim still remind me 30 years later that I gave a shmuz in class in BMT that the kollel didn't exist then. I gave a shmuz, but the guys in BMT were practically your age. You know, they came to Israel much older. I gave a shmuz that when I delivered mail during the Yom Kippur War, I felt I was being machabed my father. I wrote to my father, who was still in America, Zichrono Livracha, Daddy, I'm delivering mail just like you delivered at 225 Fifth Avenue was my father. That few big buildings there, that was his route. So I said, Dad, I'm delivering mail. It's kibud avayim. I feel when I'm doing it, I bring you honor. Okay, so he has to sign. He has to talk on the telephone. And then he goes back home. Now, could you imagine this woman is marrying a man who is a fine, upright, Orthodox Jew, member of a synagogue, looked upon, considered charedi in the terminology of the 1950s, let's say. What is she going to conclude? That Yiddishkeit requires certain surrender, but if you have to make compromises, you're allowed to compromise. It's a fabulous description. And he raises this problem. But nevertheless, he quotes the Achiezer, everything we spoke about, and he says, I'm aware of the problem. Nevertheless, this is one of the few times I converted someone in Chutz Laretz. The woman promised me her home would be 100% not influenced by the husband's going to work, going to business. Now, do you recognize this? You see, this was the world 50, 60 years ago. You don't realize what a blessed world you live in. Today it is understood, I believe, according to law in the United States, at least I know in the New York, New Jersey, and perhaps it's a state law, you cannot be fired for requesting to go home early on Friday when Shabbat begins early. You make up the time at a later time during the week, but you cannot be fired. You understand? You are protected. When I grew up, everyone worked 5.5 days. I remember in the building I grew up, I don't want to mention the name of the man because I recall him with awe. You know, I grew up, who knew Gemara? Who knew a Daf Gemara? There was one man in my building. My father was American born. My father, there were no yeshiva, there was nothing. You have no idea. My parents went to Young Israel. Somehow they were attracted to Young Israel and that type of way of life. And my mother was the only one out of six children. Her father learned yet in Volozhin, but I told you, in America he went to shul, Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. That was it. Maybe Chvei Simchas Torah. Maybe, I'm not even certain about that. So there was one man in my building who was a Europeish Talmud Chacham. He probably reached America in the 1920s. He was married to an American woman, and he would come home from work Shabbos midday. He was a salesman, and sit down, have a suda, sit and learn all of Saturday afternoon. And whenever I had a question in Gemara, I went to him, and he would help me with Gemara. Decades later, he visited me. I doubt if he's alive yet. But decades later, he visited me in Machon Gol. They told me, I don't want to mention the name again, they told me Mr. So-and-so wants to see you. Someone said you grew up in his building. And he was visiting in Israel and tracked me down. I was teaching in Machon Gold, and he came in. You know, we hugged, and he came in. He sat in the class, of course. In his old age, he was a total shomer mitzvah. But this was the mentality. Allah had come of a kamer in England where United Synagogue reigned. And those of you familiar with the Anglo-Saxon community or the Australian community, it's a very traditional community. I don't know the exact figure, but I'd venture a guess 85% of the synagogues, South Africa, Australia, England, are Orthodox synagogues. But the Balabatim are not. The Balabatim are a mixed breed. Their home is kosher. They treif out of the home. They observe part of Shabbos. I know in Australia, I saw a conservative Chabadnikim. I told you more than once. I saw this years ago. No one understood me. I said, Chabad and why you are exactly the same. We're trying to live in the modern world, and we make compromises. Some were allowed, some perhaps were not allowed. And here I am in Sydney. Melbourne is a much firmer community. Melbourne is the only community in Australia where literally you see Shabbos on the streets, and you have youth, and you have Mizrahi and Aguda, and you have Lakewood, and you have YU types, and you have Vina Hasidim, but they get along more or less because they're smaller number. There's not the split that you have elsewhere. But Sydney, I'll never forget what I saw there. In Sydney, I'm scholar in residence. I was the guest of the Mizrahi. They put me to second Shabbos. This big shul, tremendous shul built into the side of a mountain. The men have to walk up, the women walk down. I mean, it's just unbelievable. Mechitza, beautiful, everything fine and good. And the rabbis are Lubavitcher, and you should see an intelligent individual. And he wrote articles. He sent me up to it, gave me some of his Saturday night. He made a farewell party for me, sent me articles. I was unbelievably impressed. The president of the shul, one of the outstanding doctors in Australia, widely revered and respected, 100% Shomer Shabbos. The father-in-law of, take a guess, Rabbi Shmuley Boteach. That's his father-in-law, Dr. Friedman. He gave me all of Shmuley. Shmuley's a genius. I have the books upstairs. So
Friday night, I can't believe what goes on. They daven mincha. Then he gives a shiur. Then they daven Kabbalat Shabbat. Then the guest rabbi, I present the paper. It tells me you have an hour. By the time we reach Baruchu, it's 2 hours into Shabbos. The shul is packed. Then they explain to me. They're waiting for all the South Africans who moved to Sydney. It's an early Shabbos. I was there in January. I was there in June. I was there. It was their winter. It was their winter. Everywhere else, it's summer. Was their winter. I was there at the heart of their winter. Shabbos is very early. So they wait for all the South Africans to come home from work, and they have to go to synagogue Friday night. It was mamish. I participated, Joni. You're getting all my sins listed out one by one. We sinned, remember where? In the five towns, the shul we met that time. Now here I am participating in a late Friday night service. You follow me? One of the balabatim got hold of me the next day, a frum guy, 100%. I helped his daughter with a residency here in medicine, frum 1,000%. And he says to me, I don't come Friday night. I said, why not? I have to eat my Sudat Shabbos 3 hours late because of those South Africans, pardon me, Sean, Mechalalei Shabbos, and this is a Lubavitcher. But you see, Lubavitcher is just like YU. You don't like the... I'm not saying one word of criticism. Maybe it's mutter, maybe it's not. Got to talk about it. He did keep the people in shul. They never heard anything like it. They heard him speak. They heard the guest rabbi from Israel speak. They were enjoying. One woman said, in my life, I never heard anything like it. She was a South African. She ran an inn a few blocks away. They were going crazy with joy. But another Chabotnik opened up. This is right after we left. He was already building 4 blocks away. And he announced, no late Friday night business. Mincha before Shkia, Lachuna Ranano with Shkia, Bachu right after the rabbi's little talk on Pashat HaShavua. You South Africans want to come? Ship up, shape up, or ship back to apartheid. But you see, this is the world then. But what a description. It's hard to believe this description. But that's what life was like when I was growing up. Reuven Bleich, I'm sure, can give you more stories. And this is England, and it makes sense, and it's a very delicate problem. What do you do here? All right, Ben-Gurion, we know, was a Machal Shabbos. Ben-Gurion didn't fast on Yom Kippur. Paris, no one's going to accuse Paris of being a Shomer Shabbos. But here you have a man who Klapei Chutz is a Shomer Shabbos. He's called Haredi. He's prominent in an Orthodox shul. Everyone looks up to him. And he goes into his business Shabbos, he's an executive, walks his face 30 minutes, stays there 3 hours. Once in a while, they say, Mr. Boss, this is a phone call that only you can decide, should we sell his face $1 million worth of stock? No, he has to make that decision. Sign the paper. The broker wants the paper signed. Now, how frum can the woman be if this is the level of frumkeit of her husband? Okay, now, he, nevertheless, with all these problems, he says, it's a miracle what's happening. You know, this is the truth. This is the total picture. Ein bal hanes makir ben Yisrael. We are living in Israel. You suffer. We're all part of the what's happening here. You know, we're not making a living, and the economy, and the religious parties, and the secular parties, and the press, and the TV, and the radio. And you get all upset. You don't realize what's going on around you. With it all, we have more Jews living here than the United States and Canada. Who would ever believe, and he talks about this, who would ever believe that the Russian Jews will wake up? So, you know, you can say, well, look at the Russian Jews. They're goyim. You're right. There are a lot of goyim among them. But don't look at that. Look at the other side of the coin. Look at the invitation I got. I always tell the story. A few years ago, Yitzhak Kogan, who had come from Leningrad, the famous Yitzhak Kogan, Isaac Kogan, calls me. He's making a bar mitzvah. He's now back in Moscow, running a Chabad shul downtown Moscow next to McDonald's. He's making a bar mitzvah for his son. All his children are here. His daughter is the heart of the community in Chevron, in Shavei Chevron, Rosenstein. She's married to, again, the son of a big refusnik, Professor Rosenstein, Zeichet Tzadik Livracha. So Yitzchak says, Rebbe Aaron, I'm making a bar mitzvah. I want you and Malka to come. I say, Yitzchak, I, I'm free, I'm coming, a Glatt Kosher place, Tamir Hotel. We walk in, there were four people there who spoke English as a native language. Myself, Malka, the old head of Bnei Akiva of North America, Shlomo Merzal, his wife Rivka, Rivka Epstein of Boston. They're the parents of Baruch Merzal, who many of my family wasted their votes on, and the four of us. We're in this room, my word of honor. There were only two men there without beards. There were only two men there without black clothes of various types. There were only two men there who spoke English. There were 300 people there, all Russians. They gave a klap mariv. You thought it was Yom Kippur in a shushtak or in a shtibel in Vilna. These were Russians. They came from nothing. Some were Gushamunim people with bikipat srugot. Some were with black hats. Some were wearing shtreimels. There was a simcha. They came back to their roots, b'lei v'nefesh. So you see, you have to be encouraged. Problems we have. Ezra Nehemiah had problems. I say it all the time. But look at the great achievements. Look at the people we've made from. When I have a moment of depression, which is rare, but you get upset, you hear the radio, Sonny Israel, the Panovich graduates, they're the worst. You have no idea what goes on the TV. I can show you one by one. There's the most famous Mashkiach in Bnei Brak, that Tzadik Yisrael Olam. His brother is one of the main people on TV. He got his segel, and he gives his opinion, and Wurstum. These are all Talmidim of Rav Shach. The right wing didn't win them all either. If they won them all, I'd be right wing more than anyone. But all right, they didn't win them all either. We all have our problems. So I go into Shvut Ami. We're the biggest publisher of books in Russian in the world, of Sifrei Kodesh. I have two in there that are dedicated to my yarn. I should show it to you. The Sefer Mitzvah of the Rambam. We had the Rav, what we did, everything. Chassidus, Litvish, Rav Shach, Uri Zohar, the Rav, unbelievable, Rav Hirsch in Russian. Ribono Shel Olam, Ashrayayin, Rat Hazal. Accentuate the positive. This is his attitude. And he ends off that with all the problems we have to be dealing with, we have to recover them, we have to welcome them, we have to do what we can. Now, I'll show you an unbelievable source and tell you an unbelievable Devar Torah, Rav Unterman, and then a Devar Torah from that little nobody, Aaron Rakefet, that little Bronx boy who dares to open his mouth in Jerusalem, but I guess until Mashiach comes, I can get away with it. Mashiach comes, I'm in trouble. But because then Rebbe Aki Vega will be sitting behind the desk. You understand? You have to have Derech Eretz. Right now, I'm a big shot. Then, halavai, I should be sitting with the students. Rabbi Akiveiga, Rabbi Akiveiga. You know, I never knew his name. All my years in yeshiva, said, Rabbi Akiveiga, Rabbi Akiveiga, Rabbi Akiveiga, Rabbi Akiveiga. Later in life, I learned he has a name, Rabbi Akiveiga. But the worst thing was, Rabbi Itzel Petterburger, my Rebbe of Musa, Rav Lessen, whom I revere, who I have smicha from, I told you more than once, the only smicha he gave in the United States. So Rav Lessen used to speak when he gave a Musa Shmuz, used to talk about Rabbi Yitzchak Plaza, Rabbi Yitzchak Plaza. The Rev used to talk about Rabbi Yitzchak Petterburger. It wasn't until I was your age that I realized they're talking about the same person. I thought there were two different people. Rabbi Yitzchak Plaza was the Rev of St. Petersburg, in Yiddish, Tata Gehesen, Rabbi Yitzchak Petterburger. And he knew Rabbi Yitzchak Plaza. So, Rav Unterman, now this is a very unique source that you're not going to find too easily. We have a minhag in Eretz Yisrael, Lo Aleinu. It's a very sad minhag. The first part of it is happy, the second part is sad. We save money when a child is born. We start saving for the child to buy an apartment. When each daughter was born, I used to pay every month, and then they get a government mashkanta. Do what we can to help our children, Baruch Hashem. So, Lo Aleinu, young boys fall. A lot of families have a minhag that if a young man falls, they take the money that they save to buy an apartment. And they put out a volume in memory of the soldier who fell. Among the religious Jews, it's Maisim B'chol Yom Lo Aleinu. Anyway, someone from the Ettinger family, I know the family, I taught members of the family, it's an old Yerushalmi family. Dov Ettinger fell in Hebron in 1969. You think it's only today we're fighting in Hebron? We fought in 67 and 69. Dov Ettinger fought in Hebron. And they put out a volume in his memory, Dovev Svatai Yeshenim. Dovev Svatai Yeshenim. In other words, the elders should speak, or those that are asleep should speak. It's Chidushei Torah he wrote, and Rabbanim contributed articles, and it was put out in 1969, or he fell in 69, Yud Beit Macheshvan, 1969, it was probably put out in 1970, and Rav Unterman contributed an article. Now, the article was on Eved Ivri, that Rav Unterman contributed. And he gives a whole pilpul, he speaks about his Rebbe and Mir, Reb, again, these are names you don't know, but I know well, Rebbe Elia Baruch Kamai was the Mir Rosh Yeshiva. He gives Divrei Torah, and then at the end he says, let me end my article on Eved Ivri with some words of insight on the present Israeli scene. And he says, you know, we're starting to see the Russian Jews. This is 1969. The Russian Jews are starting to come. This was after the Six-Day War. There was this tremendous reawakening, which was miraculous. You don't realize that. You know, the Rav, if you've read the Rav by my friend Aaron Rakefet, you know what the Rav says there. He says, it can't be. We had an Augusta. I can't be. I can't believe it. I can't believe it. The Rav says it. Imagine, the Rav is saying in the early 70s, I can't believe it. I can't believe it's true. They've had no Torah for generations. How can it be true? How can there be a reawakening? The Rav couldn't believe it. Couldn't believe it. And I don't blame him, because he lived there. He saw the communists take over. He saw what happened in Khaslovich. And he figured from 1919 to 1970, go and tell him they're religious Jews. He said it's like, Tova Lichtenstein said, he once used the word, it's like telling me they're men walking on the moon eating cheese. He says, I can't believe it. So this miracle is starting to happen. And he tells a beautiful story here that talks about you and where you're coming from. And he says, a Talmud Chacham asked me innocently. He said, Chief Rabbi Unterman, why do you work so hard to be Mekel for the Russians and do whatever you can to help with the Gerut and the mixed marriage, and you know, who knows how frum they'll be and how much they'll observe. And when it comes to the Americans, you're not willing to lift the stone to help the Americans if they have a mixed marriage and want to convert? Absolutely nothing. Not reform, not conservative. Yikov Adina Tahar, they have to convert 100% properly. And he said it, and he said, this man asked me the question innocently. And he said, it's a wonderful question. And he said, this was the answer I gave him. Nu, what's the halacha? Look into Hilchat Avodim, Perek Bet, Halacha Zayin. What's the halacha? When a Jew is sold to an Akum, you do everything in your power to redeem him. There's a special halacha. O Dodo, O Ben Dodo, Yigalenu, Beitin the Rambam Paskin's coffin at Krovov. You know what that means? They forced you. I've seen similar concepts where the Beitin sits down for this. I knew a story where a girl was getting married, a Yatoma. There was no money. And a Beitin sat down in Bayit Vaganam. This were Mizrahi people. Bayit was a Mizrahi settlement originally, believe it or not. But this was Rav Minahar, Zeichet Tzadik Livracha. And the Beitin sat down, and every relative was assessed a certain amount of money. Every relative. The Beitin gave a psak, you know, the uncles, the cousins, each one had to contribute so the girl would have money for a dowry, for an apartment to bring in her share to the marriage. And everyone paid. I mean, with dignity. The Beitin made a psak, and everyone paid. And it's a karov. The same thing. This is the halacha. What's mean your uncle or your cousin? God, why should I have to put money out of my pocket to redeem my cousin? The idiot sold himself to a Gentile. But what's the reason? Shelo yitamei ben akum. Why do we do it? He shouldn't become like a Gentile. Because if you work for a Gentile, live in a Gentile house, what's going to be with Shabbat? What's going to be with Kashrut? What's going to be with Tarat Mishpacha? Nothing whatsoever. So that's why the Torah says, you got to go out of your way. The uncles, the aunts, the cousins, all the relatives. If that idiot sold himself, you have to do everything in your power to redeem him. On the other hand, if he sells himself, if he becomes an Eved Ivri, no one has to lift a finger to help him. Right or wrong? You don't have money to redeem yourself. Work 6 years. You'll go out with the seventh year. You go out with Shemitah. You'll go out at the end of 6 years of work. The seventh year, you'll go Chavshi. No one lifts a finger to help you. Why? And the reason is obvious. If you're in a Jewish home, you can be Jewish.
If you're in a Gentile home, you'll be influenced. So Rav Unterman says so beautifully, the American Jews, nothing impedes them from learning Torah. Nothing interferes with their accepting Torah. They have total freedom, total free choice. There are endless shuls, endless rabbanim, endless yeshivat, he says. If they went and messed themselves up, we do not have a special obligation to help them. They live in an environment where they're in every, quote, end quote. But in Russia, they had no Judaism, no rabbanim, no yeshivat. They were literally sold to the Gentiles. They lived among the Gentiles. They married the Gentiles. All they saw were Gentiles. If that is the case, we have to do everything to help them when they come back to the Jewish people. They could not help themselves. It's not like the American Jew. The American Jew, Yikov Hadinah Tahar. The Russian Jew, I'll do everything. I'll be flexible and compromising to bring them back Tachat Kanfei Hashchinah. Isn't that a nice word? It's Dashanut, beautiful. Yitem Hashem, he says, this Chesba, the one who asked the question, he loved my answer. Yitem Hashem. Powerful ending. That the Eibishter should help. We should accept Torah mitzvah, the entire yoke. We should worship God with all our soul and not be subject to any foreign influence. Ki avadayhem, they're my slaves, God says. Chazal say, we're not to be slaves of others. So now I'll tell you my vod. Believe me, I said this, I have guts. No one pays me a salary, so I can say what I want. It's not Mr. Ein Zemel anymore. Zichrono l'vracha. Nevarach Hashem. So today, I'm a free man. I may be a poor man, but I'm a free man. So I dashed this in Woodmere. I'll never forget. And the people, on one hand, they said, oh, what dashed? On the other hand, they wanted to kill me. But Rabbi Heschel, in that shul, there's a whole history. When Meir Kahana died, I was there for Shabbos, and I said, I'm going to eulogize Meir. And Rabbi Billet says, you can't do it. I said, Rabbi Billet, he made me into a Zionist. He was the Madrich in Bnei Akiva. I'm going to eulogize him. He got up. He says, ladies and gentlemen, we have a very distinguished guest here, as you know, but I must issue a disjointer. Rabbi Rakefet has told me he's going to eulogize. It was Mamish the Shabbos after his death, right after his funeral. He was killed on a Sunday. The funeral was Tuesday, as I recall. And this was that Shabbos. So the funeral in Israel was Wednesday or Thursday, whatever it was a whole week of mourning. Lo aleinu. So he says, I do not agree with his viewpoints on May. He issued a disjointer. Then I got off of my drash with Baruch Hashem. When I finished, Rabbi Binyamin Kamenetsky kissed me in front of the whole congregation. So I figured, Baruch Hashem, I'm doing okay. When I read Reb Nussan's introduction, you see that he writes about his great neighbor of Meir Kahana. So I see that the Kamenetsky children evidently have a mutual admiration society for Reb Meir. Zeichet Tzadok Lebrach Hashem Yikom Damoy. Listen, let's be honest. If the world had taken his assassination seriously, there would have never been a 9/11. There would have never been the whole world would have been different. But, they didn't take it seriously. They laughed. He's an extremist. He's this. He's that. They didn't do the intelligence work that had to be done. And look at the price we have paid. And Meir, I don't want to go into great detail. Meir was a... I have a lot to say about Meir. I write about it in my second chapter, what destroyed his life and how I learned from that. And there's a lot to be said, but it's not for now. That's for the rabbinate and for being a human being. Meir allowed a bad experience in the rabbinate to warp his personality. And that was tragic. He could have been the prime minister today. I don't believe it. Meir, he was extreme. He was not extreme. He was no more extreme than Arik Sharon. Look what became of Arik Sharon. Understand? But there's a big difference between... Okay, but not for now. So those of you that think that are not followers of Meir Kahane, don't think the Rebbe is altogether off the wall. I know what I'm saying. I know Reb Meir, and I know the greatness. I know the problems. But I have to be Makkah Tovah. When he was sitting shiver for his father, so a whole group of BMT kids went to visit him. And he said, BMT, Reverend Kevin, I made him into a Zionist. So the kids came back and said, absolutely true, every word true. So anyway, there's a pasuk in Yeshayahu. Watch this pasuk. Yeshayahu, this is mine now, but it's based upon the same thought. Yeshayahu Chav Zion pasuk, and it's homiletics. It's homiletics. Johnny, it's homiletics, so don't pin me down. Chav Zion pasuk Yud Gimel. And you will recognize this pasuk because you daven on Rosh Hashanah. V'haya b'yom ha'hu yitaka b'shofa gadol uvau havdim b'yeretz ashur v'hanidachim b'yeretz mitzrayim v'shtachavu l'ashem b'har ha'kodesh b'yerushalayim. What does it mean? Havdim b'yeretz ashur, those who got lost in Eretz Ashur, and those that were pushed away in Eretz Mitzrayim. And what will happen on that great day, latid lavo? They will come and bow at the holy mountain in Jerusalem. And I explained as follows. There are two types of Jew that we have to inspire and encourage to return to Israel. There are those nidachim. They were pushed away, Eretz Mitzrayim. What does Eretz Mitzrayim symbolize? Oppression. Hatred of the Jew. Enmity. Egypt. Eretz Mitzrayim. Okay. That's Russia. They were pushed away. They had no choice. Religion was not tolerated. Judaism was hated. No rabbis. Rabbis were executed. Chabadnikim were executed. Rabbanim were executed. Siberia, you all know these are facts. No yeshiva, no synagogues. Every city had one synagogue, totally under KGB control. I just got an email from America upstairs that they discovered the tapes of Rabbi Levine, the chief rabbi of Moscow, his visit to America in 68. And he spoke, they have it on tape where he's speaking about the greatness of labor. And the wonderful person working on these tapes wants my opinion. Did he speak about that because of the communist regime? And I faxed back, I don't know how to use email, but I faxed them back right now, that, what are you talking about? His Chazan Stitzkin, who accompanied him and gave a performance, was a KGB agent. And every word he said went right back to the authorities. And of course he spoke about the greatness of labor, the communist system, every Soviet person entitled to work. Sheshet Yamim Taseh Melachtecha. Of course it was for the communist ears. That was Russia. Hanidachim b'Eretz Mitzrayim. We have to go. We have to reach out. We have to inspire them. We have to bring them back. But there's a second category. Ha'ovdim b'Eretz Ashur. What is Eretz Ashur? Lashon Osha. Happiness. Wealth. The way we live in the Western world. Have you ever been to Boca? Have you seen the mansions? Have you seen the swimming pools? Have you been to Back Lawrence, if I'm pronouncing it correctly? Ribbono Shel Olam. You only had a problem with women with sleeveless looking at pictures when you're not saying Kriyat Shema. I tell you, it's forbidden to look at Back Lawrence by day or by night. Ribbono Shel Olam. Have you been to Hancock Park in Los Angeles? Have you seen Hancock Park in Los Angeles? Oh, Ribbono Shel Olam, they weren't pushed away. Here there's no anti-Torah. Here religion is respected. Here the president goes to church on Sunday. Here a presidential candidate can be a Shomer Shabbos who will worship in Georgetown and walk from the White House to the synagogue in Georgetown. I would imagine, I can tell you exactly, it's about a 20-minute walk with all his entourage and then the Secret Service, so it'll be a 25-minute walk. Here religion is respected, but it's Eretz Ashur, Hanidachim, you're pushed away. Pleasure. and all the modern ideas, and a man can have endless pleasure. Man barely suffers. He forgets that he's in distress. He forgets minamamakim. In Tullo Aleinu, he's in the hospital. He's on top of the world. He has money and power and prestige and fame and the good life. And they lose it. They lose their commitment. They lose their strength. We have to influence them. Halavai, the day will come. Bayom hahu yitakav shofar gadol ubo avdin b'yeretz Ashur in Woodmere, in Teaneck, in Boca, in Hancock Park. V'hanidachim b'yeretz Mitzrayim, the Jews from Kiev, from Moscow, from St. Petersburg, from Riga. Vishtachavula Hashem, Baha HaKodesh, B'Yerushalayim. Mordechai, how do you like it? And stones were thrown at Rakefet in Woodmere. But Avery, Baruch Hashem, the Rebbe does not lack for guts. You know what I'm talking about in Baltimore? You ready? My schedule, I sent a student, was going to Baltimore. I said, you sit down and work out my whole program. I depend on whatever you say, I'll speak on, obligates me. And we worked out the whole, one of the talks, the making of the Gadol versus Art Scroll. Gentlemen, my maiden voyage, and my mind is already soaring. Aaron? You don't understand. Reb Nosson Kamenetsky thinks white and lives black. A guy like that they put in Chayram. Me, they can't touch. I think white and live white. What are you going to do? Put me in Chayram? So what? I don't live. I'm not in your world. I'm in a different world. My world doesn't exist. Then why you? If I walked in, Reb David Mills came back and told me, you walk into the YU basement, you don't know where you're in Lakewood or YU. You know what I'm saying? I can't. I go to Chovev Torah. I can't walk in with those guys. They're one step out of. My Rebbe, I see my Rebbe before me. Yerushalmi and Shkolim, my Rebbe. I talk to my Rebbe. All right. How do you talk to your Rebbe? A Talmud has to be Neman L'Rabbo. So Baruch Hashem, put me in Chayrim. Listen to my talk first. If you have any honesty in you, you'll say, this man has a point. Don't have to agree, but a point I have. I'm going to tie it into enlightenment and the whole problem of being out of the ghetto and the renegades and then the problems of chinuch. And remember, if we're going to take the criticism seriously, you've got to eliminate about a third of the Agadah in the Gemara. Gemara says, this guy was fat, this guy had stomach trouble, this guy had a temper, this guy, you follow me? This guy had a Yetzirah. It's right there in the Gemara. Kol HaGadol Mechavero, Yitzro Gadol Mechavero. Did you ever understand that? How do you say a thing like that? The Gemara says it. My Rav Soloveitchik, the Rav Moshe Feinstein, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, Rav Yosef Eliyahu Hankin. How does the Gemara say a thing like that? If you know the headlines in America today, the Gemara was right. And I take a look in the RCA book, the latest scandal. He's a member of RCA. Shem Yerachim. Gentlemen, you now get your reward for coming.
Did you just mention
Yerushalmi and Shkolim? Yeah. I mentioned in the introduction to the Rav that you should always have Betzel, always see your Rebbe's shadow in front of you. Even if your Rebbe is not alive, even if you're not sitting in front of your Rebbe, a Talmud never forgets the Rebbe from whom he received the Torah. And this is what makes me a Talmud, and this is what gives me strength, sukkah. It gives me insight. It gives me the ability to think. And whenever I have a difficult problem, I always say, what would the Rav have said? What would the Rav have done? That's my way of living. So, Sean, the words of Torah. Reuven, we needed you to prove something, but the boys will tell you afterwards. Yes? What are you talking? I gave a talk in Staten Island right after they built their new shul. This is 1978. And I gave a talk. I said, I know you're very happy. You built this new shul. 1,000 families there, Staten Island, Young Israel. They've inherited the earth. And I say to them, you know, I can't go back to the shul that I was bar mitzvah in. The neighborhood is so bad. Even if I wanted to see the church, I can't go back. I said, you're building this beautiful building, but you're building it in Golas. When you build, look at Meir Sharim, it was built at that time 100 years before. Real estate is thriving in Meir Sharim. 100 years later, every building is standing. Every Baal Tshuva from over the world, where does he want to live? You should see Russians that live in Meir Sharim live in Geula. And I said, where are you building? Why are you so happy? Atmat HaKodesh, they wanted to kill me. They just finished their building campaign. But one good thing came out of it. Avery Gross, there was a fellow sitting there, a lawyer, a YU graduate, maybe 2 years younger than I am, Avraham or Avery Gross, married to a Central Yeshiva high school graduate, a girl from Crown Heights, Harriet Gross. I don't know her maiden name. I know her as Harriet Gross. And Avery couldn't make Havdalah. He told me he cried for 1 hour because he can't go back to the shul where he was bar mitzvah in Staten Island. His father was one of the original pioneers, Ruby Gross. Reuben Bleichel recognized that name, a man who fought for Torah when it wasn't fashionable. Zecher Tzadik Livracha. He couldn't go back to the shul where he was bar mitzvah. Out of that talk, the Gross family came in Aliyah, and they live in the old city, Lekavod Ulatiferet. So Baruch Hashem, sometimes you got to get into trouble, but it's worth it. Gentlemen, let me go one drop further. One drop further. It's a fascinating, the material is overwhelming, but one drop further. And I'll show you, here's the source, you'll find it in the newspapers, but I have it here right in front of me. You see, Rav Shlomo Goren becomes chief rabbi. And we're going to talk about Rav Goren tomorrow. It's a good part of the Shia. The Rav and Rav Goren did not have the greatest relationship. But part of that was just the personality clash. It's not so much that there was a basic hashkafa or halachic difference between them. It was a personality clash at its basis going back to 1935 when they first met. Rav Goren was a very revolutionary individual. And I weigh my words and I'll explain myself. I'll give out material tomorrow from the Atei Neman that Ruvain gave me. I xeroxed it, so you'll see the whole attitude. The right-wing world did not trust him. Rav Yoshev did not trust him. Rav Goren was a chevrona, was a big Eloi. And I'll tell you, this is making of a gadol. I'm going to say something that anyone from the Odd Scroll world will be very upset with me, but I heard this from Gedolei Yisrael. Rav Shlomo Goremchik, his father was in Kfar Hasidim, Pelish of Jews came in Aliyah, the kid had an Eliyah Shekup. Rav Goren knew all of Shas by heart, Bavli Yerushalmi, there's no two ways about it. He had an unbelievable mind. He went to Hebron Yeshiva, and he would go and talk and learning. He was 16 years of age. I know this from my witnesses. I'm going to say something very sharp now. He went to talk and learning with Rabbi Zalman Meltzer. Rabbi Zalman Meltzer was the Eitz Chaim Rosh Yeshiva, was the Kletzke Rosh Yeshiva, was a Gon Shebegoinim. We're talking Rabbi Zalman Meltzer. This was Rabbi Aaron Cutler's father-in-law, the Eben HaEzel. You have no idea. He was Zunamira, he was called. He might have been the most beloved Talmud of Reb Chaim from Voloshin yet. Yeah, read Making of a Gadol. I don't tell Rabbi Zalman. Gadol mi Rabban Shemo. Read about him in Rakafet Aaron Chelek Aleph. There's an essay on him. When Rabbi Shlomo Goremchik walked in, Rabbi Zalman stood up for him. And people told me this was a bad mistake. A 16-year-old kid you don't stand up for. Of course, it goes to the kid's head. You know, you think you're all powerful, you know everything, you can conquer the whole world. And this was part of Rabbi Goren's personality. He became a loner. He was a law unto himself. He was a chevrona who knew everything. He fought in the War of Independence. Ben-Gurion came to him and made him the first chief rabbi of the Israeli Defense Forces. He set up and has tremendous schuyat, tremendous schuyat. He set up an army. I mean, I know a little bit about the Israeli army. I served, I knew the inner workings of the rap, and I still know it. Some of you know I'm still in the army on special assignment, but that's a different story today, which not yet can be spoken about. But you know what we used to say in Rab Goren's time? That if somebody mixed up meat and milk in a base, Sunday morning, Goren was there, and there was a public court martial. That was Rab Goren. Didn't tolerate any monkey business. Another chief rabbi after, you know, nice people, made an investigation, set up a committee, slapped the guy on the wrist. With Rav Goren, there was no monkey business. But he was military rabbinate. When he came into the civilian rabbinate, elected chief rabbi in the early 70s, so his chief rabbinate was stormy. And part of it was, they used to say to Rav Goren that you, in the military you can give orders, you can give commands, you can be a loner. In the public rabbinate, you have to interact with other rabbanim. Not always are you right. Not always can you have your way. You have to be flexible. There has to be interaction. He had difficulty with that. And it was part of the army, part of the personality. And also, it's a bad mistake. You know, Rav Goren, Rav Issa Zalman stands up for you. You know, he wanted Machaber and Eloi. I understand it. But if, believe me, if I have a kid who's an Eloi, I should smack his face if he's 16 years of age. You know, let the kid know you have to have derech eretz, you have to grow up, you have to be mature. There are other people. I once had a kid in BMT, my word of honor. I was the first Rebbe who had who knew more than him. This kid knew a world, came out of Ramaz, a Ramaz graduate. And finally, I said, I'm going to teach this kid a lesson. And there was a madrich, I'm going back now 30 plus years, it's Yosef Tzvi Klausner, Harav Yosef Tzvi Klausner. So Duck Schlissel, Avram Schlissel was the madrich. I say, Avraham, you keep score. And I would interrupt every shiur, throw a question at him, and he could throw a question at me, and he kept score. I defeated him 2-1. But this kid, I saw this kid as filled with self-importance. We find his shalom, you know, he came from Ramaz, he thinks he's the Gadol Hadar. Knock him down a little. Did I do right or wrong? I have no idea. All I can tell you is he's in his 40s today, not married, and dreitzer. So maybe I did wrong and I smacked myself. So you can't win. You can't win. Believe me. You win, you lose, you lose, you win. But I think on the other hand, who knows what he would have been if I hadn't... you know what he had to do with me? I exempted him from the final, and I said, Klaus, gets all excited, he's exempt from the final, 500 words on Tyrus Cobb. And he looks at me, I said, Tyrus Cobb, the boys, he was known as Ty Cobb, don't get upset with the Tyrus, the boys will fill you in. He was born, his parents were over 50, he never went to a baseball game. So he went to the library, 500 page report, Ty Cobb, beautiful piece. You guys don't even know about Ty Cobb, his mother killed his father, you don't even know that. There are reasons why Ty Cobb was Ty Cobb. So Rav Goren, when he came into the rabbinate, at times he would express viewpoints that had a lot of lumdus to it, but it was an individual viewpoint. Now, one of his most fascinating viewpoints, and you'll see how this became a cause celebre in the 1980s afterwards, he said as follows, that what does conversion mean? We all see that many of the Achronim were willing to admit that b'diyeved the conversion is chal, even if there won't be total shmirat mitzvah. You see Rav Chaim Moshe, you see Rav Moshe, although we have to say that Rav Moshe himself wouldn't do such a conversion, but he said anima lameid zchut, which means that b'diyeved he too was maida. What's the main thing in conversion? You want the person to remain Jewish. Regardless of how much he observes, we want to be sure the person remains Jewish. So Rav Goren said, when it comes to the state of Israel, we certainly can be lenient when it comes to conversion. Why? Because here they will remain Jewish. It's not America. It's not Canada. The moray of the country, the general overtone, the milieu in which we function is Jewish. And you all know it. We spoke about it. Everyone lights Hanukkah candles. You know Rakefitz fought that half the people lighting Hanukkah candles don't know what they're doing, because if they were alive at the Hellenist period, they'd be Hellenizers. What are you lighting Hanukkah candles for? But everyone lights Hanukkah candles. Everyone participates in a Seder. 99% of the population. And if I'm overstating it, so it's 95%. But still, the army has a public Seder. The president makes a public Seder. There are all endless stories about Storim, and it's in the newspapers. And before Shavuos, Mariv, I don't know about Yediot, I'm probably Yediot too, but Mariv and Yediot is, you know, sells more copies here than I think the New York Times. It's unbelievable how many had a rag like that. I believe they sell more copies today than I think the New York Times sells 800,000 copies today. I think Yediot sells more. So Yediot and Mariv come out in green before Shavuos. Matan Torah, green, Bikurim. In other words, you're going to remain Jewish. Doesn't mean you're going to be a tzaddik, but Jewish you will remain. And Rav Goren took the point of view that in Israel we can be more lenient than in Chutz Laretz. Now, a tremendous storm broke out with one of the most fascinating cases you can imagine. I'm quoting here from Pardes Revisited. This is an article by Rabbi Dr. Danny Sinclair. Some of you know he's a teacher on the Israeli scene. I've met him a few times. He's younger than I am. He's taught in Machon Gold. He taught in Pardes. I don't know where he's at today, but he's a fine teacher. And he knows responsa literature. And he did an article published by Pardes, probably to show you what they're capable of doing in their school, on dealing with conversion. It's called Rabbinic Discretion in Selecting Candidates for Conversion. And he gives some of the background. Danny Sinclair. He's English. You fellas don't know him. Rabbi Dr. Danny Sinclair. He, according to here, he teaches in Jewish law at Tel Aviv University. And he has a number of degrees, including a doctorate of jurisprudence, and he is formerly rabbi of the Edinburgh Jewish community. I would imagine he's a graduate of Jews College. He probably studied in Israel. He's supposed to be a fine Talmud Chacham, a good teacher, Danny Sinclair. I know that he taught Machon Gold. I know that at one point we might have even taught as contemporaries of Machon Gold. I know he taught in Pardes. And here it says he taught... teaches in Tel Aviv University Law School, so I don't know where he's at today, but we can assume that he's still in some of these schools. 1989, there was an interesting story that rocked the country, made all the papers. What was the story? A woman converted in Israel to marry an Israeli, woman from England, non-Jewish, and... later, this woman went back to England. And in England, evidently, was a battle between her and her ex-husband. And the Beis Din in England declared her not Jewish. And Rabbi Gorin submitted a letter that although he converted her, her conversion is no longer valid. And on that basis, the Beis Din in England ruled that she is not a convert. Invalid outside of Israel. If you want to see the article, he quotes the Jerusalem Post, March 3rd, 1989. I remember the case well. Now, what's happening here? What is Rabbi Gorin saying? I mean, this is hocus pocus. That in the state of Israel, his conversion was valid. The minute she leaves the state of Israel, the conversion is not valid. It's like a passport. Passport, valid in Israel only. You know, when you get a passport, it tells you, I don't know today, but I remember American passports tell you which countries you can't travel to, North Korea, North Vietnam, whatever. It says in the passport, this passport is valid except for, this is a conversion, valid in the state of Israel, not valid outside the boundaries of the state of Israel. Now, what's going on here? And Rav Gorin explained himself. That he is always chayshish when there is conversion, there will never be proper observance of mitzvot. So he's willing to be lenient when it comes to the state of Israel, because a person you convert in Israel will remain Jewish willy-nilly. Or as we say it in modern Hebrew, al apam v'chamatam. As the Rebbe used to say it in his English, willy-nilly, they will remain Jewish. Outside of Israel, where the person is not a proper shomeret Torah mitzvah, this woman is not Jewish, because the fact that she left Israel has gone back to live among the Gentiles is indicative of her becoming a Gentile. She will be chozer or chozeret l'surah. She will go back to her roots. There is nothing to keep the inherent intrinsic Jewish values in her life. Now, I don't have to tell you, Rabbi Gorin's ruling caused a tremendous storm. Can you divide a conversion like that? Can you say that in Israel it's valid, and then if she leaves the country it's no longer valid? Very difficult to say. Is there some truth to what he's saying? Yes. there's basic truth that a conversion in Israel is going to be worth more than a conversion in Chutz Laretz, and with all the difficulty of Shmirat Mitzvah and all that happens, and the nun and the partner who's Jewish and their lack of Mesirat Nefesh and their lack of observance, but in Israel you remain a Jew. The environment is Jewish, the army is Jewish, the language is Hebrew, the taxes you pay in Hebrew, everything around you is Jewish. So you can call it a nationalistic conversion. That was the term that the newspapers used. That in Israel, at the very least, Ami Amech, going back to Rut HaMoaviyah, that at the very least, it's a nationalistic conversion. And that's enough to remain a basic Jew. It's a fascinating topic. Rav Gorin got involved in a lot of controversy. This was one of the latter controversies. I have my own qualms with it. I'll explain why. You'll see. But nevertheless, it's a fascinating point of view. I can tell you that this point of view is what influences Reb Chaim Drukman. I've told you many times that in the contemporary Israeli scene, Reb Chaim Drukman is one of the leading people who is lenient when it comes to conversion. He's willing to convert children without the parents and adopted children and Russians, and he's involved with Ulpanim, and he's running classes, and he's encouraged conversion. And you'll ask why? I mean, Reb Chaim Drukman, you should know, is a Jew. You know him as a politician. You know him as being involved in the Knesset. But I can tell you, Chaim Drukman is a Jew who's Bucky and Shas. You should know this. You should know the level that Reb Chaim Drukman is on. You don't want to believe me? I heard this from a Baron Soloveitchik too. Reb Chaim Drukman with the Pnei Menachem was the Gerer Rebbe, the previous Gerer Rebbe. They were literally like brothers. You have no idea how close their relationship was. And I didn't have others. Others told me about it. I saw it with my own eyes. They understood each other and loved each other and respected each other like Siamese twins. We're talking about the Pnei Menachem, who was the previous Gerer Rebbe before the present Gerer Rebbe. So you're dealing here with a great Talmud Chacham. You're not dealing here with a Kal Dat. You're dealing here with a man whose own personal life is exemplary. If we're talking today in a day when once again Orthodoxy has been dragged through the muds in the United States, and I checked the RCA manual, this guy they arrested yesterday or 2 days ago is a member of RCA. The fellas in the caller told me they heard him speak. He spoke to them as part of the supplementary rabbinic program. So, you know, Orthodox... I don't even want to repeat that. The names are all over the world. A guy named Israel Kestenbaum was arrested, a rabbi who won awards for being a chaplain of the year, for a chat with minors, propositioning them via internet. I mean, let me not even repeat what I read already. In the States, and he was arrested in New York. The New York Times front page, Daily News. I have it here, Daily News front. Every newspaper, Los Angeles, every newspaper in L.A., you know, the Kamotzei Shalom Rav. Could you imagine? With all the church scandals, now they got a rabbi picking on 13-year-old girls. I mean, I can't even repeat the words. What's the difference? My tznia doesn't allow me. I also have boundaries. Believe me, I can't even repeat the words I read. I'll give it out after class. You can take what you want. So anyway, I have to tell you, Reb Chaim Drukman, his personal life is exemplary. He's married to a woman from England. She's a medical doctor at Sadeket Yesod Olam. The children, they adopted children. They raised strangers in their home. I mean, ain't gomrim al Reb Chaim Drukman at the Hallel. I have to tell you, he was pulled into politics against his will as a personality to attract. He organized Morasha. He offered me once a seat on his party. I could have been a politician. I turned Chaim down over the phone. He said, why don't you think about it? I said, Chaim, with all due respects, you can manage it. I have to remain just behind the desk. I don't know if it was right or wrong, but a number of times I had to give that answer to political parties. I didn't want to leave teaching. Baruch Hashem. I always talk about Rav Moshe Tzvi Neria, who says the worst 4 years of his life were the years he was in the Knesset. And if you would know who Rav Moshe Tzvi Neria was, Zecher Tzaddik Livracha, his father was a Balazhin, he was a Litvisher. What that, you should hear the Rav talk about Rav Moshe Tzvi Neria, what that man did for Torah in Israel. Remember, he took it out of the ghetto. Who built the Yeshivat Bnei Akiva? Who set the path for all these tens of thousands, today hundreds of thousands of kids who are not going to live in Gula, not going to live in Mei Sharim? You got this man, pioneer, Kfar HaRoeh, give all the credit in the world. You know, don't forget who the pioneers were. Don't be like, why you? Why you? You mentioned Bernard Revel's name. No, who was Harav Dr. Dov Revel? You mentioned Harav Dr. Shmuel Belkin. How many times I've pleaded someone should do a doctorate on Dr. Belkin? Kol Karei Bamidba. No one listens. Ain't Keshev V'ain on there. But anyway, Chaimka is very mekil. And why? I've heard him speak more than once. He says, in Chutz Laretz, there's almost no shmir. You do a conversion. What do they observe? How much do they observe? 90% of the time. In Eretz Yisrael, you do a conversion, Yom Kippur, Rosh Hashanah, Pesach, Purim, Shabbos, people don't work. I mean, they know Kashrut. You understand? With it's so easy to keep kosher here. With the least desire, you can run a Jewish home. And nationalistically, you're caught up. You're an Israeli. You're a Jew. You're here. That is Chaimka's viewpoint. And that's why he's lenient to the extent that he is. Finally, let me end off the class. There's one solution that halachically would solve all problems. I've proposed it. Others have thought of it. I don't want to say I deserve all the credit, but many have thought of it. Some try to work it out. And I'll tell you what the solution is. That we have the problem of conversion, that we have people coming in with mixed marriages, that we have the Russians that are totally intermarried. And let's face it, Americans, South Africans, We have problems from all over the world. They're coming in Aliyah. We don't want to compromise the halacha. And I say with all the lumdis in the world, and I can say many pilpulim and a lot of lumdis, but, you know, once you compromise and you wave Shmirat Shabbat and Kashrut, so what do you have? Say you have a nationalistic Jew, but you know what I'm worried about? Remember what I told you last week, or the week before in the Rabbi Soloveitchik class? If Israel is only a moledet and not Eretz Yisrael, you'll trade it in so your kids will move away. What good is it if you came in Aliyah and your kids wind up in Los Angeles? And this week's Mariv, there was a big article in Sof Shavua on two Israeli kids who went to Los Angeles, DJs, I guess that's disc jockeys, and two kids after Rami in their mid-20s, one is named Wurzberg, the other is named Berger, disappeared off the face of the earth. No one knows where these two kids are today. So, you know, what's the good? We want them to be Jews, we want to observe, we want them to know it's Eretz Yisrael, not just Moledet here, not just another homeland, not just another country for you. So, if you run an Ulpan Ligeira and you teach them, make one requirement. After the conversion, they have to remain in a controlled environment for 30 days. Shabbat, Kashrut, Tarat Mishpacha, whatever it is. Kibbutz Adati. See, this would be fabulous. Because look what I've accomplished. Once they observe mitzvot for 30 days, there's no posik in the world who could say it's not a good conversion. All right, then they go out. We can't control people forever. I mean, at least from my point of view. I'm living out of the ghetto. I recognize we can't control people forever. I'm aware of that. But, one second, Yoni. But if they observe for 30 days, they're a chazaka. They're in. They're Jews. They're like any other Jew. Then they leave. Now, that's a fabulous proposal. I'll tell you what the problem is. The problem is today there are too many. See, this proposal was good when we were converting hundreds. Today you're converting thousands. It's a problem. What they tried to do, and Yitz Rubin would fill you in on this, he's in a lot now. I don't know how he had the cycle to get out of here, but you know what their prediction is for this week. So after tomorrow, I might not see you the rest of the week, because you know, when snow falls there, the city shuts down. They're not prepared for it. They don't have the equipment. You can't drive, you can't get anywhere. It's not a picnic, but thank God I finished teaching tomorrow morning and I can hide, and you know, but I hope I'll see you. Yes, Rav Hashem. Yitz Rubin would fill you in. Today what they try to do is assign every convert to a family, to a religious family. All this is beautiful. Problem is when you have, it's like money. Investment people will tell you, if you give someone $100, he'll turn it into $200. If you give him $1 million, he's going to find it very hard to turn $1 million into $2 million. And that's what investment is all about. The more there is, the harder there is to play with. You know, 100 you can sneak in and sneak there, but when you're overwhelmed with the, where are you going to put it all? Same here. This idea is a fabulous idea. It works beautifully when you have hundreds. When you have thousands, it's a lot more difficult to put it into effect. But in theory, this would solve every problem. I would do the conversion. 30 days they remain within. Take it off. It's picnic time. At the end of 30 days, you give them the conversion certificate. Have like a graduation ceremony. Halachically, it's fabulous. They try to do it. I have to say that these places that Reb Chaim Drukman runs, I believe there are two places under his supervision that he has, an American, Aviar, I believe his name is, Rav Aviar. He runs one of these upanim. They try to do it. In theory, it's fabulous. I recognize that when you have thousands, it becomes infinitely more difficult. Yes, Yoni? No. First of all, Yoni, you know, I've now lectured on this topic for a year. So we're talking about people that want to convert. You understand? So our problem is there Shmirat Mitzvot? Once they observe for 30 days, there's a chazaka. Seida. Now, to the second part of your question, it's very simple. Look, if they've gone this far and they've converted, I have enough confidence. I want to believe that a Jew who experiences a Shabbat, who sees what a Jewish home is, they're not going to leave. I believe they're going to see, they're going to do. I'm only going to tell you the story of Uri Zohar. You know the story of Uri Zohar? How did he become from? No one knew. You know, when I came in Aliyah, he was like Marlon Brando when I was growing up. Right. How did he become from? How did Uri Zohar, was Mr. Israel, this is the movies, the TV personality, this, that. By the way, I'll say one thing about him. He did not play around with women. This you should know, that even when he wasn't from, he experimented with dope and then, you know, a little bit this and that. He never played around. It's interesting because in his crowd, you know, the Hollywood crowd, I don't have to tell you, he did not play around. You know where he came from? He was the height of success. It's the mid-70s. He meets a Rabbi Zilberberg. Do you know the English Chumash, the two-volume Rashi in English? It's the son of the guy who did that translation. He lived in Shari Chesed. He ran a Talmud Torah in the old city. He died a few years ago. His son now runs it. Zilberberg's Talmud Torah. He met this Zilberberg, and he told Zilberberg he has a lot of questions to ask. He has questions. And Zilberberg said to him, I don't want to hear your questions. But I guarantee you, if you spend one Shabbos in my house, you will not have any more questions. And he said to Rizal, I'll make one condition with you. You can't drive. Rizal said, fine. Uri Zohar went to a hotel. Zilberberg lived in Shari Chesed. I don't know if he stayed at the King's or the President. You know, one of the hotels in the area. And he went to this guy's house for Shabbos. Was his Shabbos guest. And he saw a Jew and his wife sit down, surrounded by their children and their grandchildren, biyahava, b'shalom, b'reyut, with love. By the time of Havdalah, Uri Zohar had come back to his people. So I have confidence. And you know something? Zilberberg never let him tell how he became from. You know how it leaked out? When Zilberberg had a terrible tragedy, 1988, his daughter, her name was Weiss, she was traveling. She had a husband, learned in a kollel in the Beit Shan Valley, I think Tveria, some kollel. They were coming back to Yerushalayim, and they were ambushed outside of Yericho. And Zilberberg buried a daughter and two grandchildren. An Israeli soldier of Italian origins, David De La Rosa, went back into the bus and tried to rescue them, got smoke poisoning, and died 2 days later in Hadassah. I recall his name, David De La Rosa. Shem Yikom Damo. When Zilberberg said Shiva for his daughter, the grandchildren, Uri Zohar was in the house all day for all the days of Shiva. And the newspaper reporters picked up that this was the man that made Uri Zohar from. And then Uri Zohar told the story. So I have to tell you, I stand in awe. I stand in awe because Uri Zohar became from, his wife became from, his children became from. Now, some of the kids did not remain Haredim. They became lo aleinu like the Rebbe, Datiim. Not too bad. You should hear these kids talk. Uri Zohar's best friend, Arik Einstein, remained outside his people. But his wife, Alona, became a tzaddeket. And she, they had to get divorced. She's a tzaddeket. The charity that that woman does, the chesed, she lives in Bnei Brak. And then she told her story. How when she left Riga to go to Israel in the late 30s, she was a little girl. You don't know this, but Lubavitcher Rebbe, when the Russians commuted the death sentence on the sixth Rebbe and exiled him, he went to Riga. Latvia was independent yet. Riga was filled with Lubavitcher Hasidim, the real Hasidim, the old generation. And an Eltera Lubavitcher, a man then in his middle age, gave her a bracha, mein teire tochter, ihr sollt no bleiben a jiddische tochter, my dear daughter, you should only remain a Jewish daughter, gave her a bracha. And she went in Aliyah, remembered the bracha, became an Israeli, totally forgot Shabbat and Kashrut and everything else. And she came back, heart and soul, that Jew, in his old age, he was in his 90s, was privileged to leave. The communism fell. He came in Aliyah, and he came to see her in Bnei Brak. They were reunited. So many generations later, the Jew who gave the bracha and the girl who got the bracha. And I'll tell you something else. Two of their children married each other. Uri Zohar's son married Arik Einstein's daughter. Uri Zohar's daughter married Arik Einstein's son, Kulam Kedoshim Utahorim. So you see, I have confidence. B'diavad, not worse than Reb Moshe Feinstein, not worse than the Achiezer, Baruch Hashem, Yesh Li Amal Lismoch, B'diavad, Reb Shlomo Gorin, a national conversion. But imagine 30 days, Shomrei Torah Mitzvah. So, gentlemen, next week, the final lecture on Geirut, you will problems that no one ever dreamt about will dance before your eyes. The commenter class next week, $72,000 to the IOU list. And with that, Mordechai, it's a bargain. But what can I do? The Rebbe's giving it away as a gift because he loves every student here. Let me reiterate. Jack, don't even write it on the IOU list. Lehefech, IOU.